Hopefully the technology will work. I was having a little bit of trouble getting my computer set up right before. So I was at a conference for work last week, and we were having issues in most of the rooms we went into and changed settings. And in getting those settings back just right sometimes is a little tricky. I do want to take the opportunity first to thank the elders for giving me a chance to speak again. I thank everyone for coming. I was hoping maybe it wouldn't be in the news and notes and they wouldn't announce it so everyone would be surprised, but I appreciate everyone coming in spite of knowing who was going to speak this evening. It's always, I think, the other men that have the opportunity to do this. It seems like we always have these thoughts running in the back of our mind that might make a good lesson, and then when it comes time to put that lesson together, you never know exactly how it's going to come together, if that's the direction you wanted to go. And so I was trying to choose between two or three different directions for this evening. So I guess you can let me know after the lesson is done, if I made the right decision. When I think back to the time that I was in basic training, there's quite a few things that stick out from that, even though it was so long ago. But one of the things in our training during that time that they really, really impressed upon us was that we really weren't smart enough to make a lot of assumptions. And that the decisions that we were going to make, and if we were ever in that position of being in leadership, that those decisions needed to be based upon as much fact as we could possibly have. And when you get out of that atmosphere and you start to look at why that is, there's a lot of reasons for that, because in the military circumstances, those decisions you may be called upon to make very well take the care of other people's lives in those decisions. So it's not something that you can just go on, something that you think might be true, whether it may be or not. And so that was one of many things that stuck with me from during that time. So I thought, well, you know, those same things can be true of spiritual things. There are times that we come together and we meet, you know, three times a week, sometimes more in the case of gospel meetings. We have some interactions with one another, and based on those interactions, we make certain assumptions about how others are doing, about how others are daily lives are going, how they're doing spiritually, different things like that. And I just wanted to look at maybe a few examples this evening of where that can be dangerous. And so, you know, the question might be, why do we make assumptions? I think we make numerous assumptions every day. To some degree, I think we make assumptions that tomorrow will come. I don't know if any one of us got up this morning thinking, I may not see tomorrow morning. So we make that assumption and we make those plans. Most of us are probably planning to go to work or planning what our activities are going to be. We also assume that if there is a tomorrow, that we're going to see it come. So we've already assumed that there is going to be a tomorrow and we're going to be a part of that. We assume we know those around us extremely well. And then maybe this is the most dangerous one of all. We often assume we are right or correct in most things. And so sometimes we give ourselves a little bit more credit maybe than we should. And so that brings that, the truth be told, we often know much less than we give ourselves credit for. And then that's why we oftentimes make a lot of assumptions, because we may think we know more or have more knowledge than we really do. So just a couple of definitions quickly as we go on further into the lesson. An assumption is a thing that is accepted as true or certain to happen without proof. It's hard to look at these definitions and not think of the meteorologists every time they do a weather forecast. You know, so they'll tell us it's going to snow a foot tonight. Everybody empties out the stores, and we don't see a foot of snow the rest of the winter. So you know, we are very reactionary to assumptions that other people make. The action of taking on power or responsibility. In our political past, we've had individuals that if something happens to the president, they try to jump even the chain of command and assume power. So that carries that. I thought it was interesting that part of the definition or part of the characteristic of making an assumption, it even carries with it the idea of arrogance or being presumptuous. So kind of keep that in your back of your mind as well. The word assume, the shorter word of that, supposed to be the case without proof. Take or begin to have power or responsibility, and then as well to take on. So I just want to notice a few examples. And we're going to be in Job for the first part of our lesson this evening. So if you want to go back there, we're going to notice a few passages. I do want to assure you that at some point I do intend to get to the place where I have a lesson that's not dealing around suffering. But as I was thinking about this lesson and sometimes the assumptions we make of others and the things that they are going through, I realized that as I continue to go through certain parts of what the last couple of years have brought my way, that I continue to learn more about that, and I continue to identify more with Job in some ways, even now, 2.5 years or so out, than what I did even within that first year. There were places that I didn't let my mind go in that first year, year and a half, that unfortunately it's kind of gone there now. And so I thought, well, if some of those things are coming my way, then maybe they're going other people's ways as well. So I just wanted, the first example I want us to look at is some of the assumptions of where not only our mind can go, but where possibly the minds of those that we care about and those that we are around, where their minds can go at times also. So when we look at Job, we've already had the first 12 verses read for us, and it reminds us of the way that Job was considered to be, that he was a righteous man, that he's one that God even presented to Satan. Have you considered Job? And you know, that's kind of that can be a two-edged sword, because we want to be in that position that God would look at us in that light, but at the same time, it brings some attention from Satan. I think another assumption that we would be good, not, you know, to be aware of is that as we are looking at the congregation here and looking at other elders being put into place, possibly that, you know, Satan could very well look at that as a growth and as a strength. And usually when he takes notes of things that are spiritual strength, he wants to do things to try to slow that down. And JD did a great job this morning of outlining our responsibilities. Well, if those responsibilities aren't fulfilled, that's Satan trying to creep in and cause trouble in what would otherwise be a sign of spiritual strength and things moving forward. So it's not only the example of Job, but it's even the things that have been brought to our attention lately. You know, we would do good not to assume that Satan is not aware of those things as well. And so just keep that in mind, that any time that there is spiritual strength and there are good things happening of a spiritual nature, that Satan takes note of that. And so when we get into the further, again, I'm not going to read the rest of chapter 1, but we remember the loss that Job experiences in that first day. Verse 16, while he was still speaking. Verse 17, while he was still speaking. Verse 18, while he was still speaking. And it was just loss after loss after loss of the possessions and of the children that Job had. Verse 20, then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. We look at this, and when you get on into chapter 2 as well, that's not good in it. You know, Job has the proper response. Satan looks at that. Satan comes back again in chapter 2. And he's not satisfied with what has been taken from Job at this time, and basically says to God that flesh for flesh, if I'm allowed to touch his skin and to bring that sickness upon him, he will curse you to your face. And so we see those things coming about as well. And we continue to see that Job's responses are good, that Job's responses are proper, and he works through those things. But the things that we want to notice about this is, I'm afraid sometimes that we see Job's reaction in the latter part of chapter 1. We look into chapter 2, you know, again in verse 3, have you considered my servant Job? In verse 4, so Satan answered the Lord, skin for skin, yea, all that a man has he will give for his life. In verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Verse 9, then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Verse 10, but he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And even early on in my years as a Christian, and when I started first bringing lessons, I would really hone in on these parts of Job and his reaction and failed to look at some of the rest of the book. And what we do, if we do that, we find ourselves going through difficult times, times of struggling, whether it's physical sickness, spiritual sickness, being the caregiver for those that are sick, whatever those pressures are. And we've just made the assumption, and others often make this assumption for other people, that if you're a righteous person, that's the way you respond automatically and in every situation that we come up against. And we end up in a way setting individuals up for falls and for difficult times as life comes their way and as these things go. And so then sometimes when those reactions are not what we see in Job immediately, sometimes when we see individuals that don't respond the way that we assume that they should, now it's almost like if we're not careful, we begin to question their spirituality. Well, if they didn't respond the way Job did, then they must not have been a righteous person. And sometimes those that are suffering through those things can pick up on those things, and now we've even got something else that we need to deal with. Let's go to Job chapter 3. And notice parts of Job chapter 3. When I put on the screen the idea of where our minds can go, there are times that we find ourselves reacting to things and pondering things that happen in our lives that when we look back on that, we're like, if you would have presented that to me 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said those thoughts would have never been a part of my daily life. But then when we look at going through some of these things and enduring some of these things, we find those times that for whatever reason, we go to the very place where we thought we would never be. And so appreciate that as we notice some of Job's comments in chapter 3. This is the same individual that said at the end of chapter 1 that it was said of him, "In all this Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong." The same individual in chapter 2 that was correcting his wife in the way that they ought to feel. But chapter 3 and verse 1, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, 'May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it.'" Right, drop down to verse 11. "Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came to the womb, from the womb? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breast that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built ruins for themselves." Verse 25 of chapter 3 as well. "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes." And so we see a little bit difference in Job's responses a little bit later. We know that there's times that his friends comes to him, and those friends are not exactly the greatest comforts in the world. When they first come, they sit there for 7 days and 7 nights, and they're not saying anything. And so just trying to take in the position that Job's in. When they finally do get around to saying things to him, it's accusations and assumptions that there must be sin in Job's life for these types of catastrophes and this situation to come upon him. And so if Job is related to us in the beginning of this account, as a righteous man, if he is accounted to us as an individual that God would put before Satan and say, "Have you considered Job?" And he struggles at times with that response, why would we think that we would not do the same? And so, you know, the question comes sometimes, well, you know, when we ask people if they're doing okay, you know, I mentioned this in a lesson a little over a year ago. Somebody's coming up and they're going to ask you the question if you're doing okay. And then before you even realize you say, I'm fine. Because that's the easy answer that we get accustomed to. That's the response that people want to hear. Sometimes when individuals' minds are going places they thought they would never go, they're afraid to let other people know. And I think sometimes that we get in a place where we're afraid to let other people know because we've made assumptions that righteous individuals react as Job did at the end of chapter 1 and not in chapter 3. We want to separate the two Jobs, and we just want to concentrate on when Christians face difficult times, they respond the way that he does at the end of chapter 1 and part of chapter 2. But somehow it's not okay if we respond the way that he does when he wants to curse the day of his birth. That somehow it's not okay when later he wants to reason with God and to some extent ask God or reason with God why these things have come upon him. And so by making those assumptions, sometimes we do not reach out and become the help that we need to be. Don't get me wrong, even after some of the things that I've been through, I still don't feel that I reach out to the others the way that I should, and certainly we'll need to continue to work on that. When we continue to look at other parts of Job in chapter 7, he talks about the effect that some of these things are having on him. In verse 13 beginning, when I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. What is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? I think that probably one of the key points we miss in when we are struggling through the issues of this life is that we also forget that Satan doesn't go away. You remember the first part of Job? It wasn't enough to take his children. It wasn't enough to take his possessions. It wasn't enough to take his livestock. It wasn't enough for his wife to turn and to turn on him as well. It's like, I want him to be sick as well. And so Satan's approach is, I want every possible obstacle to be put in his way. If you're saying this is a righteous man, I want to have full realm and full power to approach him and to try to turn him. And so it's not only the physical burden of doing that, we see Job having to go through and to deal that with the mental part of that as well. And sometimes those are the hardest ones for us to discuss, and those are sometimes the hardest ones for us to come to grip with. And so let's look at Job chapter 29 and a couple more passages in Job, and then we'll move on to our next point. But Job chapter 29, and we'll just notice a few of the verses there. So Job 29 began in verse 1. It says, Job further continued his discourse and said, Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, and when my steps were bathed with cream, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me. The other thing that Satan really likes for us to do is to kind of increase the suffering, increase the things that we're going through, by reminding us of what we perceive to be better times. If we had that time in our lives where things were easy and things were flowing somewhat smooth, well, the way that Satan can keep us from turning to God and to dwell upon Him is to get us to think back to those times. And what Satan actually does when he does that is he gets us to the point where we want to blame God for where we are now instead of where we were. When actually it's God that's still watching over us and blessing us in both those situations. But Satan wants us, he wants us to lose sight of that knowledge. And really what he wants us to end up doing If he can get us to the point that we blame God for the situation that we're in, he starts to drive that wedge between us and God. And that's where the danger comes when we start assuming things of a spiritual nature. If we allow Satan to convince us just enough that God has something to do with the situation that we're in, with some kind of intent or ill will toward us, Satan's opened the door for us to assume that there must be enough truth in that, that we turn away from God rather than to Him. And the danger in those assumptions is that another assumption, I'll try to say this without getting my mind, without getting too many assumptions in one sentence and lose the point. The danger in doing that is that we make assumptions that everyone is struggling, that the things that they are struggling through, that they are okay with that. We make the assumption that as we come together, if we're functioning, if we're able to move forward, if we're able to do certain things, we make the assumption that they're okay, and that may not always be the case. Yes, part of that is on those of us that have been through those things. Sometimes we don't share that the way that we should, but sometimes there is fear in doing that. And if we can be more aware of that, and that we're making our decisions and trying to help based upon knowledge and understanding of those things, it's much better than making assumptions that everything is okay. So there's some dangerous reactions of where we could go in our mind when we're dealing with ongoing suffering. And really, I think that the longer some of these things continue on, probably the greater risk some of these are. But, you know, sometimes we don't want to speak of Christians and depression together because, again, we've made this assumption that if you're a righteous person, that depression should never be a part of your life. If you're really trusting God, if you're really reading His Word, if you're really doing these things, then the assumption is you should not deal with that. But then again, we forget Satan's influence in changing the way our mind works sometimes. The reality is that sometimes these things can cause us to stray away from God. The reality is that we can get to that point to where Job kind of knocked on the door doing his well and blaming God. We can get to the point of asking why. If you were here, I don't remember, it's been a while since I watched the memorial service, but I think I may have said something about avoiding asking the why questions. Well, it doesn't mean that just because you say it at one time and in place in a service that you don't ask those questions later. That's Satan again trying to work in his influence. And then there are other times, and I've seen this in older Christians that maybe all of their loved ones, all of their brothers and sisters in Christ that they've known have passed away, and they get this feeling that they're just done and they just want to go home. And sometimes those of us who are younger and we're not at that place yet, we assume that there's something wrong with that, but we make that assumption sometimes out of selfishness because we want them to stay, or because we don't understand what that feeling is like. I remember having a discussion, something like that, with Deanna's grandfather. You know, after living a long life of being a Christian and after being basically the only one of his generation and of his contacts left, there was a better place that he wanted to go. And what right did I have to want him to stay here longer when he was ready to make that next step? And so again, sometimes those assumptions that we make, again, it can be the sick, it can be the caregiver, and it can certainly be the spiritually sick. So let's go to Job chapter 42. I am not going to leave this point there. We need to look at the end that there is that avenue and that way of getting back to where we belong. But we want to make a few points on that. In Job chapter 42, let's begin with verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. And note, if you will, Job's turning around in thought. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. Remember the meaning or the definition of assume and assumption. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. So what we see at the end of the book of Job, and we know as we read on that God does bless him, and God blesses him once again. I think where we need to be careful as we deal with one another in these types of areas is we need to realize that what's not mentioned in the book of Job is a timeline. And so the worst thing that we can do is assume that somebody's come through a trial, they've come through suffering, they've fallen away and they just come back. The worst thing in the world that we can do for those individuals is assume that there's a time stamp and they have to be over that and moving on by a certain time. Because we don't know what that time is, and that time frame is different for everyone. There are individuals that we know of that have been through things that it is amazing the way that they have carried on and have moved on and kept their faith intact. That time frame is different for different individuals. And so we just want to keep thinking about that. So we'll close this point on this next slide. And please, as I say some of these things, don't think that, you know, it's an effort that I'm not looking for everyone to feel sorry for me or anyone else, but just think of the other losses that we've had in the congregation. Think of the other suffering that we're aware of that goes on. And just understand that there is a time frame that it takes oftentimes to heal from those things. So, you know, from my personal experience of my loss, it's been almost 2.5 years. And so again, you know, someone might look at that and make the assumption that, well, you know, things ought to be running pretty smooth by that point. But this past October 1st, we hit a pretty big deadline at work. It's probably good that I'm still here, that my staff didn't kill me, because we set a self-imposed deadline for October 1st, and the amount of work to get that done was pretty incredible. And I pushed my staff pretty hard to make that, and was even taking on a good portion of their work so they could kind of just focus themselves in on what they needed to do for that. And so, you know, it's about 3:30, we're ready to hit submit, so we've got the big photo op and everything, we made the deadline, we're going to push submit. Well, then it was 2 hours before I actually took it because we had issues with some of the things, but, you know, we're all excited and everything at work because this was coming through and we made that. And then I practiced this so I could get through this. So but later, I went to the phone to start to text Deanna to let her know. And hadn't done that for quite a while. Sorry. This past week, I also saw a colleague that I used to work with in Indiana at the conference in Michigan. And he was talking about getting home and getting back home to her. And his remark, he thought she had that under control. And he didn't know about the loss. Made the trip back Thursday night to get back so that it could be at Reagan's grandparents' day on Friday. And just with everything else that happened recently, that's the second time that made that trip alone. And then this will ring true with many other people in the building this evening. We have the holidays coming up. And so while we're getting together with our families and we're celebrating those holidays, there are going to be some of us that are going to be dealing with that in a much different way. And again, the one of the most difficult things we can do is assume that those individuals that are not near as far in to the loss as I am, that will be an okay time. It's extremely difficult, and it is year after year. And so let's try to base those decisions and those reach outs on the knowledge that we have of them and try to find out as much as we can, because that road back to that spiritual strength that many of us once knew, it can take a while. And so I hope that that through that we'll appreciate that a little bit. Okay, we're going to go on to another subject so we can get my voice back under control. I just have a couple of slides about the eldership here and making assumptions. I hope that as we look at our current eldership, that we as a congregation appreciate what they've done for us over the last few weeks. If you've ever been a part of a congregation that does not have elders, or if you've ever been a part of a congregation that have elders that are not really qualified to take on that position, I hope that that helps you appreciate what we have here and the efforts that they have gone through to make this process as open and as gracious as it can possibly be. There's a couple of things for us to notice on that. They truly are a blessing from God for us in the way that they are watching out for our care. I don't really have time to go into it tonight, but there's another story from basic training that I think really shows the way the eldership works. I can share that with you sometimes, but it's probably the most frightened I ever was during that 6 weeks. And it involved a drill sergeant trying to get in the door who did not have permission to get in that door. My responsibility is that regardless of what he does or says, he is not to get through that door because he's not on the bulletin board next to it as having access. That man did everything but bust out the glass and bust through that door and yelled many, many things, which is not good to remember. And was so red in the face that I thought something was going to explode at some point. He eventually quit, turned around, and walked off. It was my responsibility that no harm came to the people inside that building. And in the discussions of the eldership lately, it's kind of made me think of that, to the efforts that they go to protect us as the members here. I hope we see the graciousness in the process that they decided to use in looking at the possibility of adding additional elders. I hope, and JD did an excellent job this morning of outlining the roles and responsibilities. He only made me nervous once. I saw the word assume come up on one of his slides, and I thought, how much of my lesson am I going to lose? But, you know, so I do appreciate that lesson this morning, though, because we have a clear understanding of what our role should be. But just realize that not every congregation is as fortunate as we are here to have those men that will look out for us. So I know that we've looked at a couple of these passages a lot lately, but I wanted to refer to Titus just to make a reminder of the graciousness that they, in the way that they have led us through this process. So in Titus chapter 1, and we'll begin with verse 5. Says, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking, and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you." And then again, we've looked at those qualifications a lot lately. But you know, there's some assumptions that we make around this, and any time that it comes talking about this idea of eldership. So let's look at that. So that which was lacking was the fact that there were no elders in place. And so what we have finding is that Titus has been given the responsibility to put those elders in place. Once that need is fulfilled, then we see the eldership and understand that the eldership is going to take on the authority for the future decisions of that group. And so what the elders at Lakeview have allowed us as members to do is to provide input into or toward those possible selections. The assumption that we need not make is that they had to do that. In all the meetings that we've had, in all the study that we've done on that, I hope that that has sunk in on us, is that for them to come to us and to get our feedback and to let us be a process, they did not have to do that. That is something that they were willing to do because of their care for the congregation and their desire to make the best possible decision. So I hope that in all the things that have been said and studied and brought forth and in our understanding of the authority that the eldership has, that we understand that one as well. In 1 Peter chapter 5, let's read those four verses really quick, because I think this exemplifies the attitude that they have carried out with us. But in 1 Peter chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, it says, "The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion but willingly, not for dishonest gain but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away." And there are numerous other scriptures that I could have read in addition to that, but we have looked at those over the last few weeks and even this morning. But again, an appreciation for the way they exemplify what Peter was instructing them to do in 1 Peter chapter 5. And so I hope we take that appreciation and that we will share that with them. Our final point this evening is that of salvation. You know, if we're not careful, we can make assumptions regarding salvation as well. And sometimes that's in sharing the gospel with others. Sometimes that's even in looking at our own lives. But let's turn to Acts chapter 9. And in Acts chapter 9, we look back and we look at the account of Saul. And I think that probably at some point in our lives we can think of someone that we may have been guilty doing the same thing to some degree. In Acts chapter 9, beginning in verse 10, "Now there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and to him the Lord said in a vision, 'Ananias,' and he said, 'Here I am, Lord.' So the Lord said to him, 'Arise and go to the street called Straight, and inquire the house for Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus, for behold, he is praying. And in a vision he has seen a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him so that he might receive his sight.' Then Ananias answered, 'Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem.'" And we know how that account ends up. But when I was thinking about this idea of making assumptions related to salvation, I think of verse 13, and the fear maybe that Ananias had of going to Saul, but maybe making a judgment call that, you know, based on what Saul is involved in, why would this individual have any desire to hear the truth? What would someone like Saul, what purpose could it possibly serve to take the gospel to him based on the way that he's living his life? And the question came to me as I was thinking about this lesson, how many Sauls do we come in contact with in our lives? That because they seem to be very rooted or grounded in the way that they are applying the Bible to their lives now, that somehow we've made the assumption that they wouldn't be interested in the truth? And when we look at Ananias being encouraged and going and doing what he was doing, God tells him, you know, basically tells him, "I've got use for him. I've got use for him, and so you need to go." I hope that we will take that same approach. And I often wonder ourselves of how many of us in this room were Saul of sorts, where somebody could have said the same thing, that we were grounded in something else, but someone showed us the truth, and the truth had the effect on our hearts that God intends for it to have. And we're here now and gathered with other brothers and sisters in Christ because someone did not make that assumption about us. But then finally in Acts chapter 24, and this is where we want to offer as an invitation this evening, is to think about where we are spiritually right now. You remember at the beginning of the lesson we said part of the issue of our assumptions is that most of us are probably planning up and already made plans for tomorrow. That we're assuming that tomorrow is going to come. We're assuming that we're going to be a part of that tomorrow. And if our lives aren't right with God, we often make the assumption is that we're going to have a time at some point before we die to make that right. That's assumption that's not based upon fact. And that's an assumption that we do not know. Acts chapter 24, beginning with verse 24. "And after some days," and this is after Paul had the opportunity to speak to Felix and to make his defense with him in verse 24. "And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, 'Go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you.'" As we continue to study through the Bible, we never really find, we have no record that Felix ever found that convenient time. And it's the same with us this evening, that if we're here and our lives are not right before God, this is a perfect opportunity to take care of those things. Whether you need to become a Christian this evening, or as a child of God, your life is not right with Him and you need the prayers and the support of the congregation here to get back on track, such as Job needed to do toward the end of that book. Please don't leave this building tonight without making those things known. Because just as we talked about this evening, we are not able to make the assumption that we'll have another time to make those things right. If you're subject in any way, would you come while we stand and sing?